with session two of New Religious Movements in America. I'm Bruce Wallenberg. A good place to start in terms of talking about new religious movements in America would be if we don't talk about Native American traditions, about which we could say they are new in some sense at some point. We would say 1893, World's Parliament of Religions. Swami Vivekananda comes, three-piece suit, looks good, sounds great, stays, establishes Vedanta centers all over the country. We could say 1965, because before 1965, Asians were excluded from this country in large numbers. They couldn't immigrate. There was a kind of reaction in the 1920s against the yellow hordes, too many Asians coming into this country. And so in 1924, the Asian Exclusion Act was passed. And this was vacated, revoked in 1965, meaning many Asians were coming into the country and still are coming into the country. I mentioned in Los Angeles, you have 22 types of Buddhism. Where I am starting tonight is 1844 with William Miller and his prediction of the return of Jesus to inaugurate the millennial kingdom. Now, those of you who are Roman Catholics, those of you who are, well, mainstream Christians, don't know much about or have not heard much about millennialism. It may be in the periphery of your vision, but it's not central as it is for a lot of American evangelicalism, as it is for the hard version of American evangelicalism, which is called fundamentalism, which is also a new religious movement. Fundamentalism is not simply a return to original Christianity. Fundamentalism is a particular type of hostile to modernity, ready to take on, in a pugilistic sense, modernity type of evangelical Christianity. Where was I going with that? Fundamentalism. Dan, help me.
William Miller.
Centrality of millennialism to evangelicalism and to fundamentalism. And those of us who come from the mainstream traditions have left millennialism to the side. But a lot of people in this country get a lot of kick out of looking at history millennialistically. Gold star for that, huh? So here we have these words that go back to Irenaeus and other original Christian thinkers in the second and third centuries. It's not a new religious movement in that sense. It goes way back. There's been speculation. You can see it in the New Testament. I mean, the people who were originally arrested by the figure of the risen Jesus Christ thought that he'd come back next Tuesday. The people that were originally arrested by the risen Christ thought that he was back in town, were convinced that he was back in town. But then, after he ascended, as it were, they thought that he was going to come back soon, right? So you didn't need, with this new religious movement, you didn't need structures, you didn't need bishops, you didn't need a new code of morality. All you needed was faith. All you needed was patience. And Jesus would come back, and history would come to an end. Well, that's a kind of millenarianism, or millennialism, or chiliasm, which is the same thing. This is more Latinate, and this is Greek. but it means the same thing. Pointing to looking for the time when Jesus would come and a reign of peace and justice and joy and righteousness would be inaugurated, either in a millennial kingdom away from the earth or in a kingdom of God, as it were, on the earth. So a renewal of society or a completely new heaven and a new earth. Not specifically Christian, by the way. There are in other religious movements this notion, this dynamic of history is going to end. There's going to be a master of ceremonies of the end of history. In other words, somebody's coming back. In Christianity, it's Jesus. In a particular form of Shia Islam, it's Al-Mahdi. It's the coming one, the one who is the master of ceremonies of the end of the age. And out of that, by the way, in terms of new religious movements, also in this country, out of a kind of excited, heavy-breathing version of Shiite Mahdism in Iran, you get Baha'i. Huh? Your Baha'i friends are, and this, I'm not denigrating them at all, but I'm just from my experience, your Baha'i friends are not going to emphasize their Islamic background. Because the idea of Baha'i is that all religions have something to contribute. And there are further revelations to come. So it's not a kind of Islamicism for them. But it is rooted in the idea of the Mahdi, the one who comes later, comes after. In this case, Muhammad. Well, as we know about mainstream Islam, Muhammad is the seal of the prophets. He's the last one. There are no more to come. God's last best effort to get the world right is Muhammad. So when you pop up in Iran and say, I, the Bob, not from the TV show, you know, Bob, the malevolent guy. And what's the name of that? No. I'm getting off the track here, but it's fun. What's that show? It was so weird, you know, and it always ended strangely. We're all too old. We can't Walter think of this. Walter Cronkite. Anyway, this guy's the Bob. We'll think of it afterwards, right? It'll pop into your mind. It's like Northern Exposure.
Twin Peaks.
Twin Peaks, that's it. And Bob, you know, is the malevolent guy. You know, I don't either. And it's off the air. Oh, the Bob is the gate. You know, the Bob comes, B-A-B, comes and says, I am the gate, not Muhammad. He was killed. That's what happens when you say you're the next Muhammad. Doesn't wash. So millennialism, Kiliasm, is not specifically Christian. But in its Christian form, we're looking for Jesus to come back. It's also that there's a related word here, and that's dispensationalism. Yeah.
Is there any consensus on the form of Jesus' reappearance will be?
Yeah, there's consensus on that, though there's not consensus, and I'm going to go into this in a minute, on what's going to happen when Jesus comes. There's no consensus on when Jesus is coming. And that's crucial. But he's coming in the clouds, as it says in the New Testament. And everybody will see him. The trumpets will sound, and you're thinking, you liberal Protestants and others, you're thinking, well, that's symbolic, isn't it? And it's not literal. I mean, you're not going to hear literal. Wrong, Kiliasm breath. You will. In this kind of religion, this is what's going to happen. Jesus will be visible, and you will hear. There'll be an audible part of it. And the earth will tremble, and earthquakes. Ha! The millennials like earthquakes. Yes. see, they read, I think it's the 7th or 9th chapter of Daniel. All sorts of things are predicted about crumbling empires and great figures rising and waning. And then the New Testament picks this up in terms of the Antichrist coming toward the end. So there's a consensus that it will be a physical, historical, visible, apprehendable event for all people. But that's about as far as the consensus goes in terms of millennialism, because there are two types of millennialism. You know this, but we'll just go over this for the sake of clarity. Premillennialism and postmillennialism. Now, I come from the mainstream tradition, so I didn't grow up with this. This is not in here. It's all up here, see? And I think I've got it right. And help me if you got it a different way. Premillennialism suggests that the time will come when the world will be going to hell in a handcart. Terrible things will be happening. In the natural world, earthquakes, fires, etc. In the political world, wars and rumors of wars. In the moral world, in the individual relational world, things will be terrible. Well, the cynical of us are saying, well, about any age can be characterized by that. Plus, there's going to be somebody who sits in the seat of God. Well, you could say that's David Koresh, huh? I am Jesus. Or, if you go back through history, you can find all sorts of candidates for that position of Antichrist. And in fact, millennialists down through the ages have found these candidates. Napoleon was a good candidate for Antichrist. In the Reformation times, who was the Antichrist? The Pope. Yeah. Somebody who sits in the seat of God. For some, it will be the president of the European Economic Community who will be the Antichrist. But in any event, the world will more and more go into disaster and moral and political chaos. Then Christ comes, snatches or raptures the good people, the true Christians. In other words, not the Lutherans, not the liberal United Methodists, certainly not the UCC, not the Episcopalians, not the Roman Catholic, oh my gosh, but not the Papists, but only the remnant, only the true people of God will be snatched up to meet Jesus in the air, and there and thence to go to glory. The rest fall under the wrath of God and are condemned to eternal fire. Then comes the millennial kingdom. So premillennialism means that Jesus comes before this period of millennial bliss, at the end of which history is over. We don't know, or as they would say, the Bible does not tell us, or it is not revealed to us, or it is not recorded for us what will happen then. But it's for sure that what we ought to be doing is, as William Miller said, look for the signs of the times. Well, he wasn't the first person to say, look for the signs of the times, was he? I mean, let's talk about Jesus, huh? Jesus says, when certain things in nature happen, you know that something is coming. Spring is coming, or fall is coming, or whatever. And yet, you don't even know the signs of the times, religiously speaking, in terms of Yahweh. So William Miller picks up a strain of biblical tradition, and he says what we ought to be doing is counting the weeks, counting the years, counting the months, counting the weeks, and then finally counting the days, because it's revealed to us that Jesus is coming, and then comes the millennium. So William Miller was a pre-millennialist. Pre-millennialism was fairly popular in the 1820s, 1830s, 1840s. After 1844, and what is called very pointedly the Great Disappointment for his followers, comes a disillusionment with premillennialism and a sense that maybe premillennialism is not the way to go. And particularly after the Civil War, you get some recovery, you get some momentum in the economy, you get a more optimistic outlook. Obviously, premillennialism feeds on pessimism, doesn't it? When things are not going bad, when the economy is bad, when we're in trouble with our international neighbors and allies, premillennialist pessimism is popular among certain groups. But if things are going reasonably well, if you're coming into the 80s and 90s, the Gilded Age, the gay 90s, when things are relatively better, preachers pop up who say, what's going to happen is that God and God's Spirit is going to help the situation along such that society will kind of evolve into the kingdom of God, evolve into the millennial reign of Christ. So that after a period in which the Christians advanced the cause of Christ, during a period in which the poor are helped and the people who need food are fed, during a period in which the gospel is preached to the ends of the earth and everybody has a chance to be saved, at the end of that period of the powerful moving of God's Spirit, Christ will come and ring down the curtain on history. So the post-millennialists are suggesting that Christ comes post, after the millennial kingdom has been inaugurated evolutionarily, rather than suddenly, as the premillennialists have. Okay, you wanna? I'll stop there and see if you have any questions, reactions.
A question about William Miller. What was his movement called?
Adventism.
As in Seventh Day.
As in Seventh Day. Okay. Let's go right to that. Ellen Gould White was a member of an Adventist family, also in upstate New York. And to make a long story short, and this is New Religious Movements in America, because Adventism is a particular American form of millennialism. Ellen Gould White comes from a Millerite family, a family that is deeply disappointed in the Great Disappointment. She begins to study the Bible. She has friends who are Seventh-day Baptists. She participates in what was a very popular movement in the 1830s and 40s and 50s, and that is, you'll like this, Dan, health food faddism. Mm-hmm. I mean, people were, it's more than that, people were really concerned with their health. Now, you know, everybody all the time is concerned with their health, right? So what am I saying? I'm saying that just like you know, in the past few years in California, there's been this great move to the hard, bronzed body, you know, more so than, let's say, in the 50s. Just so, in the 1830s and 40s, you had a concentration on ways in which to get healthy and stay healthy. This was one of the things that was in the background of Mary Baker Eddy's movement of Christian Science. In both cases, in the case of Ellen Gould White and the case of Mary Baker Eddy, they had a point. Their point was, doctors will kill you, so you better take measures into your own hands, matters into your own hands. And you've watched these documentaries on TV or docudramas of the Civil War, where they're sawing people's legs off, you know, they're drinking whiskey, and they're, you know, it's just appalling. You were probably better off in that era, in the era of Jacksonian democracy, out of the hospital than you were in the hospital, see? You might as well pray, because you'll just get worse in the infirmary, see? So, Ellen Gould White put together Sabbatarianism from the Seventh-day Baptists, that is, you worship on Saturday and not Sunday. She picked up from the popular culture health fadism and Millerism, that is, an expectation that, well, yeah, we got it wrong this time, Miller got it wrong. But pretty soon, we're going to start seeing those signs of the times, and in fact, we still see them, even after the great disappointment of 1844. They're still around, and maybe Miller got it wrong on the exact date, but the signs are all around us that Christ is coming again. So Ellen Gould White puts together this combination, making her a religious genius. A religious genius is a person who brings forth things old and new. And any religious movement that survives has to bring things out that are old and new. If it's totally new, nobody will buy it or understand it. If it's totally old, it won't find its niche in the marketplace. It has to have some continuity with the past, it has to have something new to offer, and it also has to have one other thing, and that is the ability to change. So any movement that says, we don't change, we just go back to the Quran, we just go back to the whatever, run, don't give them a dime, don't take out your checkbook, because they're history, if they really believe that. But actually they don't, see, because they know how to change. Evangelicalism knew how to change into fundamentalism in order, they think, to survive. See? So you got to know how to innovate if you're going to survive. In any event, Ellen Gould White put these things together in a new combination and added one other thing, prophecy. Now, she could get that, and I don't know whether she did or not, but she could have gotten that from William Miller, because William Miller thought himself to be a channel through which God was teaching the truth. So that if Miller didn't take the title prophet, he was simply a kind of a self-trained Baptist preacher. But Ellen Gould White styled herself and was styled by her followers as a prophet, so that her conceit was that God gave her directly, to use Mary Baker Eddy's term, the key to the scriptures. And she started this movement called Seventh-day Adventism. She fell in with a guy named Kellogg. There were two Kelloggs. One was a physician, and I don't know what the other brother did, but in any event, they lived in, you all know where, Battle Creek, Michigan. Ellen Gould White moved the Adventist movement from New York to Battle Creek, Michigan, and you know, urged her followers to read the Bible according to her lights, urged them to eat healthy foods. If they could, at all possible, go to Holden Village to learn how to eat the proper, the politically correct Adventist food. Nuts and grains and fruits. And, of course, the greatest health food of all, cornflakes, invented by Kellogg. Now, unfortunately for Ellen G. White, she and Kellogg had a falling out, and so the Adventist movement did not get the cornflake billions, and she moved the operation back to New York and split from the Kellogg part of the health food movement of the 1830s and 40s. Then they, yeah, frosted flakes. Now that's the switch on the health food business, and it's very interesting to see what happened with the doctor business, the medicine business. Whereas in former times, Ellen Gould White was saying, "Stay away from hospitals and physicians." Now, when you see on TV a major breakthrough in baboon heart surgery or you know, whatever, is from Loma Linda University, isn't it? An Adventist hospital. So, you know, it's interesting how these things flip around. Joseph Smith. Now, Smith, I put up here because he was martyred in 1844. Adventism is a genuine new religious movement, though, with antecedents, and Smith's church, which was originally called the Church of Christ, is also a new native New American religion. And the category that I put Smith's efforts is the category of a restorationism. And I also put the churches of Christ in that category. Why? Because both the Church of Jesus Christ and of Latter-day Saints and the churches of Christ and the Christian Church disciples of Christ all come from the same impulse to restore what had been lost in the past to the present. That's the basic impulse of restorationism. How you do it, exactly what you say, is one thing, but the basic impulse is there behind them all. Smith's experience was the following. You know this story, and I'm just reminding you. In the Burnover Revival District of upstate New York, in the early part of the 19th century, the situation was the following. Preacher after preacher after preacher would come through and give their spiel and then move on, leaving behind people who got on fire, but then kind of burned out. I mean, we talk about burnout today, and that's the idea of the burned over district. People were confused. You know, one day you were supposed to join the Methodists, and the next day you were supposed to join the Presbyterians and the Baptists. How could you know what the true faith was? That was a question that was on the minds of a lot of people, and it was on the minds of this religious genius, Joseph Smith. And Smith's solution to this problem was to form a church which was none of those. It was kind of a plague on all your houses, and I'll form a church which, in my mind, Joseph Smith's mind, is a recreation, yes, certainly, of the New Testament church, but more foundationally is a restoration of Israel. Now, those of you who have LDS neighbors, and those of us who live in the West, it's not hard to have LDS neighbors, right? If you needed two or three cases of Campbell's soup, you can go over there and get them from the cellar. By the way, that could be theological. I don't know. I think it's reflective of their frontier experience. The fundamental idea of the LDS religion, Latter-day Saints or Mormon religion, is the restoration of Israel. They feel they are the people of God. The new people of God. Not just the restored New Testament church, but the restored, the restoration of Israel. Why? Why is God in these latter days restoring the church? Why is God restoring Israel? Quite the opposite. They seem very settled, don't they? They're certainly the richest church around. I mean, that's a fact. It's also a rumor, but it's also a fact. You know, boy, those guys are rich. Those Mormons own Marriott, blah, blah, blah. They really do. so that's true. And they're also very settled in America. Before 1890, they were anti-American. Before 1890, the American government could go to Hades. American government was, if not the Antichrist, at least pretty close to it. After 1890, flip-flop, and they become as American as you and 10 times more. You know, I always kind of get a little chuckle when I see the flag flying at the LDS Institute at the University of Idaho, which is the first one in the nation. I mean, there they are, the proud patriots who, before 1890, wanted to form their own kingdom of Zion in the western United States, including but not limited to Utah. They wanted Idaho, too. Parts of Nevada, and I don't know what the geography is, but big theocratic kingdom that would be where Jesus would establish his millennial kingdom. So Smith's restorationism was also a millenarian movement. In 1844, Smith is martyred in Carthage, Illinois. He and his brother Hiram. So the new movement has everything they need. They have all sorts of, they have the Book of Mormon, they have Doctrines and Covenants, they have Pearl of Great Price, they've got all the stuff, they've got all the theology. And they've got one more thing, a martyr. But they also have a problem. Where are they going to go and who's going to lead them? There was a group that said that only a lineal descendant of Joseph Smith should be the leader of the new community, of the new Israel. They did not believe that Brigham Young, who assumed the presidency of the church after some struggle, should be the leader. Those who thought that the hereditary line was the way to go stayed behind. These are the Missouri Mormons. And the bulk of them followed Brigham Young in what in Mormon terms is not just a trip, not just a trek, but the Exodus. Yes. Out of Egypt, out of Pharaoh's Egypt or Jackson's Egypt, that is out of the evil empire, the United States, to the promised land, Utah. See? All in the service of penultimately reestablishing Israel and then ultimately using Israel as the center of the return of Christ. Okay, I'll stop there and see if anybody has comments.
What about that TV program, World for Tomorrow, where those four fellows come on? I like to listen to it because it's a lot of history in it. And now I find out it's 70 Adventist.
Ah,
yeah, the one he finally just came out and said that. But they did arrange, I think it comes on, in my area, it comes on about 10 o'clock on TV, and there are four different fellows that are talking.
Uh-huh.
Well, they give some good things. I mean, when they did it on Babylon and the history of the Babylonian, I love to listen to it.
Uh-huh.
And I happened to mention that to my pastor, and he looked at me and said, but that's a cult.
That's good.
Is it?
Sure it is, because a cult is a group I don't like. Yeah, but no, it's not a cult. No.
It isn't.
Well, look, the I'm not supposed to say I said this last session, so pretend that you didn't hear. See, I like to be a true Holdenite. You know, each session should stand on its own. So you're not supposed to say, well, last time, as you all know, so you don't know it. But a cult, I'm kidding, tape, oh, forgive me. Oh, tape God. The word cult is so slippery of definition that it's not helpful to use it. You know, it's like saying jerk. Well, what's a jerk to somebody is the next person saying, oh boy, what a witty guy, you know. So, I would rather say, is it a highly intensive religious movement that virtually takes over a person's life and is led by a strong kind of megalomaniacal leader? Well, Adventism is not, according to that definition, a high-intensity, emergent religious group. And in fact, they're moving the other way. With their TV program and with the magazine, the ministry that we get free. I don't know, you get that, Dan? Who else is a pastor here? We get this thing free or have for many years. They are trying to say to the mainstream religious public, we're just like you. Whereas for many, many years, they were marginalized because of some of these strange things that Ellen Gould White pulled into her brand of Christianity, like the Seventh-day thing, rather than Sunday, and the kashrut business, or kosher. You know, certain foods are okay to eat and certain foods are not okay to eat. Well, that's right from the Hebrew Bible. So they've been marginalized, and your pastor, I think, is coming out of that tradition of seeing Adventism as a strange kind of thing. It really isn't. They are attempting to downplay their strangeness and play up some of their strength. For example, everybody's trying to diet, everybody's trying to lower their cholesterol, you know, and give up smoking and whatnot, and the Adventists roll in and say, hey, you just got. We've been doing this for a long time. Linda, you?
I just wanted to say something about, you know, maybe to shape the question in a different way, to talk about them presenting the news or history from, you know, a certain perspective, obviously. You know, as everyone does, but that there may be a difference in the perspective in which they present information from which this lady's pastor may, you know, present information.
Well, yeah, I would think so, because they bought into biblical literalism. William Miller bought into biblical literalism. You know, it says what it says. It means what it means. Don't give me hermeneutics. Don't give me the straight stuff. And there's a long history to that, but the basic idea is that God doesn't fool around. God is true, God doesn't lie, and the Bible is a collection, it's sort of a file of the notions of God, of the ideas of God. So God also has placed in each of us a rational mind. So we, without fancy scholars from Yale and Harvard, you know, it's a populist kind of thing, and Chicago, and certainly not from Europe, where all those weird ideas, those liberal, Christ-denying, Bible-doubting ideas come from, we common folk, right here at the corner of 5th and Main, can read the record of God's thoughts, which are pure and plain. The only thing we have to do is to make sure that everything fits. So, you get the categories of Christ and God, salvation and whatnot, and you line up the Bible passages that relate to that topic, and you look at them all, and you come out with a conclusion. Here's what the Bible says about X, Y, Z topics. See? So if your pastor is not hooked into that kind of system, in other words, if your pastor feels that the Bible might be a little stranger book than some folks think it is, he's not going to like this kind of presentation where the Adventists know who Babylon or what Babylon is and how it fits into Bible prophecy. Is that kind of what you're getting at?
Mm-hmm.
You know.
And that some others of us might not particularly appreciate their perspective either.
Yeah. Yeah.
Bruce, let's talk a little bit about money. Now, as far as what the Seventh-day Adventists are doing with theirs and what the Mormons are doing with theirs, I don't see, and I haven't read anything about them pooling their money together like the World Council of Churches and the Lutheran Church about helping the Bosnian people and the African people to a degree. If they're not going to get anything out of it, they don't want anything to do with it. That's what I feel, and that's what I've
seen. Well, I don't think you have to be cynical about that. I think the Mormons are very clear that they are taking care of their own, and right. What they are doing is trying to bring more and more people into Israel so that eventually all people can benefit from what God has given through the prophet Joseph Smith. So, you know, I think we should judge them on their own terms. First, maybe then we want to say, well, that's a lousy theology, and let's talk theology. But first, you know, and in terms of interreligious understanding, let's understand that the Mormons are not evangelical Christians. They go ballistic if you say they're not Christians. So let them be Christians, fine. They're an odd type of Christian, but they are a type of Christian. The Adventists have their hospitals and their missions in Africa and all that, so they are helping. They, however, have historically been rather separatistic in terms of World Council and whatnot for theological reasons. Hmm. So they're not likely to join the World Council, which they would see as very liberal, you know, and as deviating from the propositions that God has revealed in an easily read Bible, okay?
Yeah.
But they may very well ally themselves with other evangelically inclined type religious movements. Yeah.
Would you say it's dangerous to watch those fellows?
No, it's fun. I love it. You know, get your clicker on
Saturday morning.
You know, get a little Adventism and get a little Brother Jed, you know. And, no, I think it's wonderful.
Yeah, watch them all.
Wonderful. You know what is really... What is destructive of your mind is any Republican. Beware that now there is a cult. Matthew Cannon, I mean, would anybody follow him? No, I'm just... Okay, now, Dan had his hand up first.
I was wondering where, if any, does the rapture come in on this? Is that what...
Yeah, that's the premillennialism.
Okay.
The world... is going to hell in a handcart at the last minute, at the worst possible minute, at the Battle of Armageddon when the forces of good and evil, and by the way, that is a perspective of millenarianism that sees world history basically not in terms of little decisions, little incremental decisions by the IMF or by Clinton or whatever, and we kind of move like this, you know, one step forward, two steps back kind of thing. That's the way most of us think of history, right? I mean, sometimes the good people win, sometimes, but you know, we're moving. Millennialists think of world history in terms of God and Satan. This has always been a bit of a problem in Christian history, in Christian theology, by the way, of having a powerful God that's good, and then having a powerful that's bad. So the Satan figure doesn't become a rival God, as it were, but there is a rival to the goodness of God. And it's almost Manichaean, that there's a powerful good God and a powerful bad God, competing for the soul of the world, as it were. That's the way you explain human history. So at the battle, at the end of time, when things are just as bad as they can possibly get, Jesus comes and snatches the people who are his, who are the true Christians in their hearts, from this earth to meet Jesus in the air. That's the rapture.
Is this God and Satan unique to Christians? Or, I mean, that's not Islam. Is it Islam?
Yeah, there's a Satan figure.
In Islam?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Iblis or Shaitan, he's known as.
Oh.
Yeah, and he fights against God, absolutely. Yeah. And then, as I say, in Manichaeism, another Iranian religion. A lot of stuff came out of Iran. Like the Satan figure that perhaps some scholars think Israel got when it was in that area of the confluence of the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. That's where Hebrew religion picked up the idea of a malevolent, almost semi-god figure. Yeah. Okay, please.
You spoke several times about, what is it you said you hated?
I didn't say I hate Republicans. Now, don't make me... don't put words in my mouth.
How are you going to say
some
that?
Of my best friends.
Cults.
All right.
Well, that's a really bad definition. I think we have to take Webster to task for that. Because, for example, a lot of people think that unificationism is a cult, right? I don't know what you think of when somebody says the word cult, but a lot of people think of movies. Right?
Right.
Okay. Moonism, that's my strange person, moon. You know it's not going to go on until I use somebody says right. Moonism is not a break-off of anything. Moon is a shaman who has put together in his theological scheme Presbyterian dispensationalism from the Bible that he read as a young man, and Korean spiritism, that is, for every element in the material world, there's a corresponding element in the spiritual world, in the world of the spirit. And he has put this together in a particular form and offered it as a world religion. So that's, you know, if that's a cult, then Webster's definition is not good. Actually, the word sect covers what you said a little bit better, but sect isn't a good word either, because usually when we think of sect, we think of small, little break-off group. Well, you know, some sects like Lutheranism are pretty big, you know, a little break-off of the Roman Catholic Church. Yeah.
How about the definition of a cult would have a live Messiah?
So you think that when Moon dies, unificationism will not be a cult anymore?
Well, it could make it a different form.
Okay, it could be the next...
Maybe they'll become legitimate.
Yeah, I don't know. It's just such a bad word that I wish we'd stop using it, you know, and talk about different types of religion, including high-intensity religions. I don't deny that there are high-intensity religions, and I don't deny that a lot of us wouldn't want to be in them, because one of the features of some of these religious groups is that you give over your freedom, you give over your critical faculties. What you get for that is a type of peace of mind. You get a type of direction in your life that you don't have to invent, that's given to you rather than what you shape. And at that point, cults, so-called, can be helpful to certain young adults. And the research has shown that a lot of high-intensity religious groups that we know of, for example, Hare Krishna or The Family or the ones that you were mentioning the other night, you know, unificationism, et cetera, et cetera. Many of them are taking in people who are not sure, they're 18, they're 19 years old, they've had a year, year and a half of college, they don't know what their major is, their parents just got divorced, they have trouble relating to the opposite sex, and somebody says, you know, come on, let's get with it. Let's have a family and let's change the world. Well, that sounds pretty good. They're in there for an average of 3 years, and they exit. So in other words, they use these groups as instruments of their own personal maturation. And when the group has done for them what it can do, they leave.
What do they carry with them after that? Is there any research on that?
Yeah, I mean, some of them are damaged. Some of them have to go into psychotherapy. Some of them, particularly if they've been kidnapped and, quote, deprogrammed, which I'm against. Painful as it is for parents, I know that. They have a tough time, and they sometimes go back to the group. They feel that that's their real home and not their home of origin. But from what I've read, many people use the group and then move on with their lives. So, you know, they don't come out damaged. They come out different. They come out more mature. They're ready to leave, and they get on with their lives. So, you know, the majority of young people do that stuff in high school and college. You know, that's the usual institution. But for some people, the institution of choice, I think we have to say, under the religious freedom in America that we have, the institution of choice is a high-intensity religious group, which gives them a kind of breather between being kids and being responsible adults. This person, yeah, please.
You mentioned that Miller and Smith organized a populist understanding for people to understand the movement, theology, and scripture supposedly behind it. How would that correspond with the Mormon understanding of procreation and the spirits? That does not seem very understandable theology as far as any religion that I know. How would you understand the emphasis on high procreation rates and how that corresponds with Latter-day Saint theology?
Yeah, well, I think you're right that idea of a Bible that can be read by anybody and interpreted plainly has to be modified with the idea that first you have to know the keys. You have to have a few principles. So you can't just open it up. But a bunch of us who aren't especially trained, but who are filled with the Spirit, and that's a key point that I didn't mention, can come up with the mind of God on everything necessary for salvation and everything necessary to understand the world. Okay. The idea in Mormonism in terms of spirits is that spirits are waiting to come into a body. The reason that they want to come into the body is not because they are sad or because they're tortured or something like that in the spirit world. It's so that they can progress spiritually. So the purpose of every embodied spirit, that is, every human being, is to progress spiritually in this life, to get a kind of run, get on a roll, and then when you die and go into the next life, you've got that much more impetus to rise eventually to Godhead. Joseph Smith hasn't gotten there yet. It's a tremendously long process of spiritual evolution. So the spirits have come to a certain point in their spiritual evolution, and in effect, God says to them, "If you want to stay here, fine. You want to be on this plane of existence, fine. But I provided a way for you to to move rapidly upward by taking a body, living in the world, living according to the ordinances of the church, or as they say, the ordinances of the gospel, participating in the rites of the temple, you will be able to progress spiritually much faster than if you didn't. So see, we all have a chance.
So yes. You're saying that the populist appeal comes with certain individual or small group that kind of set the tone of the theology. For instance, Seventh-day Adventist or the Book of Mormon, Brigham Young, they'll set the tone and then have a more of a populist spin on it. Because the theology
yes. mm-hmm.
is not necessarily biblically based. There's some biblical elements, but as theology is contextual.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you see, the revelation comes to a plain person. A Miller untutored, a Smith untutored. So that is a populist element right there. Yeah. Okay, yeah, you were...
I think it's pretty easy. I agree with most everything you say. I think it's pretty easy for us to be extremely critical of all these new movements and overlook, one, that they're filling the vacuum that our mainline churches have left. And two, that they have a zeal for persons and for saving the world and for caring and for evangelizing and for communicating that we simply don't have. And they believe in television, we don't believe in television. And when they really are aiming at a social or political issue, they're more ecumenical than we are about social and political issues. They get together. They do something about it. And I really think that they're an indictment on our faithlessness, on our lack of taking our own faith seriously.
Well, I agree. I hope you don't hear me saying something other than that. I want to be self-critical about ourselves, and I also want us to be of a tolerant ecumenical spirit over against expressions with which we may not agree and may not be attracted to.
I just want us to be mindful that they are also a challenge to us, and we need to react in doing something very positive.
Yep, indeed. I'm going to say here that it's the time is up for the official meeting, so the tape can stop if it hasn't already. And we have Vespers at 7:30, right? So we can chat for a few minutes, but you know, feel guiltless to leave now. No, yeah, over here.
I was going to probably follow up on what he mentioned was that when you were talking about religion, that religion has to change with the times, and that's where more or less mainline denominations and religions, when they do have that going on, they don't be able to keep up with the times and with how basically the world and humanity is always in that growing process.
Right.
The other part I was looking at during your presentation is just the ideal of people perceiving time itself. And people have a linear kind of projection of time instead of
right.
the time that is a circular thing.
Right.